Monique. Hi, everybody. Good evening, good afternoon, good morning, whatever time it is. I think most of us, the people I know, are more West Coast, but wherever you're located, welcome. I'm in Berkeley, California, and I am not Kevin Griffin. Hopefully you saw on the website. He's teaching a retreat with Bimala Sara, another great Buddhist recovery teacher, down in LA somewhere, that Southern California. So let's see, what can I say? Well, I'll just mention that Kevin is somebody that has mentored me in the past. If you're not familiar with me, I've been in recovery as of this month for 37 years, which is crazy. I feel like I keep checking the math on that. It's like, that can't be right. been on the Buddhist path since around 1993. I mean, I was interested in Buddhism from an early age, but got more serious when I met my first teacher at Spirit Rock, and that was Jack Kornfield, one of the main founding teachers of Spirit Rock. I used to work at Spirit Rock too, so it's kind of always nostalgic for me to teach in the Spirit Rock realm. I miss being on the land there, though, so we'll have to think about it. So I guess we will get started with some meditation. We'll meditate for about 30 minutes. Is anybody new to meditation that's here? Just checking in. It's helpful for guidance purposes. So everybody's a seasoned meditator. It's fine either way. Anybody new to this group? It's the first time here. Welcome. Yeah, good to have you. Thanks for zooming in. Let's see. Well, let's go ahead and meditate, and then I'm going to give a talk later. It's cultivating gratitude, acceptance, and truthfulness in recovery. So I'll talk about how I came up with that topic. But for now, let's do the practice together. So I'll give some guidance, and there will be some periods of silence, but I'll check in with you periodically. So go ahead and find a comfortable upright posture. I've got the new habit of putting my phone on airplane mode whenever I meditate, which I think is a good habit. Because it can be really distracting when you're meditating and your phone you get some texts or something, and then you have to like struggle to decide whether you're going to check it or not and all that. So finding a comfortable posture, if you need to lie down, that's fine, but probably most of us will be sitting. So you want to sit upright with a sense of dignity and purpose. And kind of like the Buddha under his Bodhi tree on the night of his enlightenment, we want to, you know, in Zen they call it taking your seat, but you really it's important, I think, to take a few minutes at the very beginning and just find a good upright posture that you can settle into and ease, cultivating ease, stillness, peace, calm. And you might take a deep breath or two at the beginning, just as a way to arrive more fully in this body and this present moment. We're often kind of more up in the imaginary control tower up in our head somewhere. So the invitation is to drop all that, come back to this body, this moment, in whatever way feels right to you. You might feel the contact with the chair or the cushion, feel the arms, feel the legs or the feet. Grounding our awareness in the body. my teacher says we have to establish mindfulness. So I think of this as establishing mindfulness in this present moment. And then I like to use the breath as an anchor for my meditation. So as I breathe in, I know I'm breathing in. As I breathe out, I know that I'm breathing out. So you might just take a few moments to connect with the breath. Notice the gap between the in-breath and the out-breath. And then you might also do a quick body scan, or beginning at the top of the head, just kind of relaxing the muscles in the face, softening around the eyes, loosening the jaw, make sure you're not clenching your teeth. Drop the shoulders. Soften the belly, not holding tension there. Relax the arms. Relax the legs, even the feet. And we want to have an attitude of kindness, care for ourselves as we meditate. And if difficult feelings or thoughts come up, we hold those with compassion for ourselves. So it's even okay to put your hand on your heart, maybe even a hand on the belly, to hold space for yourself if anything really difficult comes up. One thing about this practice is we're developing a refuge for ourselves that it's very reliable. We can always return to it in any moment. If your mind seems super busy, that's not a problem. It's totally normal. We just do the best we can to keep coming back to the next breath, reconnect with the sense of the body. Sitting here, try to relax into the posture. Sometimes we have restlessness, worry, doubt. These are all normal things that we just need to be mindful of. Not try to push it away, not telling ourselves there's something wrong with me as a meditator because I'm restless. There's a certain level of acceptance we need. This moment is like this. With sounds, we're aware of sounds arising and passing away, but I try to leave them in the background while I'm meditating. No need to go out and be bothered by the sound. If you're feeling sleepy when you close your eyes, you can meditate with your eyes open. Just might want to have a soft gaze a few feet in front of you. Just noticing what's here with a sense of curiosity, commitment to honesty with ourselves. Just checking in, notice whether you're lost in a story or a plan, or if you're being present with the breathing, with the body sitting here. Sometimes it's helpful to label our thoughts, like planning, planning, remembering, remembering, judging, whatever label makes sense. You don't have to overthink the label. And then this helps us kind of let it go for now, come back to the next breath. And as one of my teachers says, we can do this smilingly. It's totally natural to get lost in a story or a plan or some kind of compelling thoughts. I always say the mind is a genius at hooking us into some thought that demands our attention right now. But is that really true? Or can we just let it go, come back to the next breath? Rest in the knowing of the thoughts rather than the thoughts themselves. Another practice that I like to offer during meditation is a gratitude practice. This is not obligatory, but if it sounds good to you, you might try it. Just thinking of, say, three things we can be grateful for in this present moment. It can be very simple. Grateful. I'm grateful to be sober these past 3.5 decades, but mainly today. Clean and sober today. I'm grateful for Spirit Rock to host this and for Monique to be helping us make sure everything goes smoothly tonight. And I'm grateful for my daughter, who's not making too much noise in the background so far. So we just think of a few simple things we can be, that we are genuinely grateful for in this moment. And then let it go. Again, just checking in. Notice if you're caught up in some kind of compelling story from yesterday or plan for later tonight or tomorrow. See if you can bring your awareness back to the next breath. Feel the sense of the body. Sitting here. Trying to control the breathing in any way. We just let the body breathe naturally. We just gently stay with it, mindfully aware of the breathing. can really be present with an in-breath and an out-breath, maybe several in a row. We might get in touch with what one of my teachers calls the subtle joy of being in the present moment. The subtle joy of being in the present moment. So you might see if you can connect with that. Can't force it. Yeah, part of the art of meditation is we are not leaning forward into the next moment looking for something special. We're sitting back and fully inhabiting this moment right here, right now, this breath, in this body. Last instruction for today, that just let things be as they are. Letting go is letting things be. Okay, so when you're ready, that ends the meditation. Feel free to, you know, get up and stretch if you need to, or drink some water. I don't believe we take a break, though, formally. I'll start the talk here in a minute. So, thanks. I had an announcement I wanted to offer, which is I want to make sure everybody here knows about the Buddhist Recovery Network. And so I'm putting the link in the chat. That's a way to find these kind of meetings anytime, anywhere. Also, I happen to be speaking for what's called the Buddhist Recovery Network Academy in June, early June, June 2nd. So if you hear something tonight that resonates with you, feel free to tune in on June 2nd as well. So you'll find that at the link that I just shared. Okay, so I guess we'll go ahead with the talk. I assume everybody can hear me okay. So I was going to talk tonight a little bit. I wanted to start by talking about gratitude, and then I also wanted to mention acceptance and honesty or truthfulness. And these are all both Buddhist, important Buddhist qualities, as well as qualities that are very supportive of our recovery. And the gratitude one is interesting because there's not, if you look at the original early Buddhist suttas, the discourses from the time, you know, from not from close to the time of the Buddha, like 200 years after his death is when they, I think, were written down. But there is a word for gratitude or gratefulness called katanu, which is a Pali word, means gratefulness basically. And this is, you're not going to be quizzed on this, but I'll show you the word in the chat. But you don't see, and if you're reading the ancient discourses, you don't actually hear a lot about gratitude in there, although the Buddha did mention it a little bit, so it is there. But so I think as a consequence, we don't, a lot of times in the Buddhist world, we don't hear a lot of teachings on gratitude. And I also find that it's not the most, oddly enough, it's not always the most popular topic. But I think we should change that. But the reason I'm bringing it up tonight is, so I also have a regular monthly sangha through IMS online, which is the center, sister center to Spirit Rock. They're on the East Coast in Barrie, Massachusetts. And one of the people that goes to that sangha wrote me. He had been on a long retreat, and he's in recovery. And he wrote because while he was on this longer retreat at a place called the Forest Refuge, he was ruminating, he says, and he started thinking about gratitude. And he says gratitude was the first spiritual practice that he learned in recovery. And he was wondering why there wasn't more talk about gratitude in Buddhist practice. And he had asked some of his teachers on that retreat, and he felt that they kind of, he caught them unprepared for, they didn't have kind of like a lot to say about it. So he, I guess when the retreat ended, he wrote to me and asked me what I would say about, he says, did the Buddha instruct on a practice or reflection of gratitude? And, any of my thoughts about gratitude and Buddhism and recovery? So I just loved the question. It actually occurred to me tonight while I was meditating that one thing that I think he was getting in touch with a lot of gratitude probably on that retreat. And so, I'm guessing, I haven't talked to him about it. But so there's something kind of beautiful about that one where we're kind of opening to gratitude. And it's not always there. And it's not, I'm not always the most grateful person I could be. So I'm not trying to say I'm the master of gratitude and you all are failing because you're not more grateful or something. But I think it is an important part of my practice. And so there was that guy that wrote to me. And also I went to a regular 12-step meeting that I sometimes go to or regularly go to. And I was kind of in a funk that day. Like there was something going on in my life and in my mind that was kind of agitating me. And I went to this meeting and somebody brought up some topic. I don't even remember what their topic was, but as soon as they mentioned something that they wanted to hear about, I don't know why, but it reminded me of gratitude. The word gratitude just popped into my head. And I suddenly realized, wow, I've just completely lost touch with gratitude. I'm churning, caught in negative thinking, a cycle of negative thinking. But as soon as that thought of gratitude rushed in, suddenly it kind of dissipated the negativity. And I kind of came back to, not only the sense of just being grateful to be alive, to be clean and sober today, just, suddenly just realizing my good fortune in so many ways that I was not noticing in them until that moment. And it really just kind of washed over me. So I just think that the longer I stay in recovery, the more open I am to looking for those moments of real gratitude. And I also like this idea that we can intentionally cultivate it, but also we can just kind of be more open to it, looking for it when it's really there and appreciating it when it's there. So I just kind of wanted to talk about that. I did spend some time responding to my friend who had written that message to me, and I looked up a few things. The Buddha did say there's a sutta, a discourse about a jackal. I don't understand the whole jackal part, but in that sutta, the Buddha says bhikkhus, and bhikkhus could be any serious practitioner of Buddhist practice. Bhikkhus, you should train yourself thus. We will, quote, we will be grateful and thankful, and we will not overlook even the least favor done to us. We will be, I'll put this in the chat since we have chat access, because I think this is an important, this is a practice right here. If you want to know what the Buddha's practice for gratitude was, I guess this is as good as you're going to find. Because, yeah, there's a lot of wonderful favors done to us, probably on a daily basis, that we're not truly being grateful and thankful for, or at least some of us. So you might try that as a practice. And then Jack Kornfield says in his book, The Wise Heart, he kind of equates gratitude with mudita or sympathetic joy, which is one of the Brahmaviharas, the divine abodes. He says, gratitude is a gracious acknowledgement of all that sustains us, a bow to our blessings, great and small. And he says, gratitude does not envy or compare. And as gratitude grows, it gives rise to joy. And I love that. I think that's helpful. Joseph Goldstein, another one of my teachers, says, seeing the good in others opens us to metta, or loving kindness, and then to gratitude, and ultimately to forgiveness as an unburdening of the heart. And it's funny because we have all these little quotes from different teachers and whatnot, but there's a lot there, even in just that one little quote from Joseph. It reminds me of something that happened to me one time. I was in a teacher training, and we had these retreats at Spirit Rock regularly. And I was on one of those retreats, and I'd had an argument of some kind with my partner right before I went on the retreat. And so every time I went to meditate, the tape of whatever we were arguing about would come back into my mind, right? As can sometimes happen. And it was pretty, it wasn't even that serious, but just kept coming up. And as I'm sitting there, and I did kind of bring mindfulness to it, I'm like, oh, there's that tape of this thing, conflict we're having. And then I remembered, kind of like what Joseph's saying, I suddenly remembered the good in my partner, because she had actually helped pay for me to do this teacher training. She had contributed to I wouldn't have even been there if it hadn't been for her. I suddenly remembered, right? Like taking in the good of her generosity, which was she did not have to do that. That she totally just offered it out of the goodness of her heart. And as soon as I remembered her generosity, her good qualities, I couldn't really be mad at her anymore. It was like, oh boy, I'm a jerk. You know, it's like suddenly I just totally let go of whatever my little resentment was. And it was a really great sort of teaching moment that it can be that simple when we really take the, you know, slow down and kind of bring the practice to what's really happening in our life in this moment. And then certainly Joseph talks about how ultimately it leads to forgiveness or unburdening of the heart. I completely forgave her in that moment as soon as I really had that, took in her generosity. So I think this practice can be very, very helpful in our real lives. This is what keeps me coming back to the practice of Buddhism. And and so there's more we can say about gratitude. I just think it's an interesting topic to explore a little bit. There's a book called Mindfulness, Ancient Wisdom Meets Modern Psychology by Christina Feldman and Willem Kuiken. And they write that gratitude nourishes and supports appreciation and contentment. It is an active choice to identify all that we can be grateful for in our lives. So that's kind of like that gratitude practice. I don't know if we have to identify everything that we could possibly be grateful for, but I think it's important to think of a few things regularly that we can be grateful for. And then they go on to say we can be grateful for seemingly trivial things like a moment of kindness that a stranger shows, or more profound things like a loving relationship or our health. I know for me, I've I hadn't been sick that much until a few years ago. I have a daughter and I think she brings stuff home from school or whatever. Started getting sick more regularly than I had in many, many years. And I realized I had taken good health somewhat for granted. But boy, I didn't after I'd been really sick a couple of times, including COVID. When I got back to health, I was really grateful to be back like I am right now, knock on wood. So health is not a small one. And gratitude is an antidote to the perhaps more natural inclination of the mind to identify everything that is lacking or imperfect in our lives. So this to me is the real important line. Oh yeah, thanks, buddy. Here's the quote, that quote, that gratitude, the it here is gratitude. It's an antidote to the perhaps more natural inclination of the mind to identify everything lacking or imperfect in our lives. When I first got into recovery, I was pretty negative, but I wasn't that aware of it until I grew up in and got sober in Virginia. But after I'd been in recovery for a few years, I decided to kind of like pack all my stuff and move to California. It's a long story, but so I did that. And I'd been out in the San Francisco area for a few months, and I thought of my friend in recovery back east who I hadn't talked to. This is before cell phones. So it's like, but I realized I should call this guy and just say hello, somehow thinking he was going to be so excited to hear from me. And he had more recovery time than me, but we had bought a canoe together, so we were bonded. But anyway, I called him up. He answers the phone, and I'm like, "Hey, it's me, Walt. I'm out on the West Coast now, but I just thought I'd call and say hello." And his first comment was, "Oh, hey, Walt, are you still so damn negative all the time?" I mean, like, he was sort of happy to hear from me, and that was his first comment. And it really hit me. I was like, ouch. I did not know that that's how other people might be perceiving me. And I definitely knew I didn't want to be that person, you know. And I think that was, I kind of carried that over from my, you know, days in the caught in addictions. So I think gratitude is a wonderful way. I guess what I'm trying to say is I definitely am somebody who had and can still have an inclination towards finding what's wrong in this moment. And so I think for me, it's been really helpful and important for me to be developing gratitude in different ways in my life to kind of counterbalance that tendency towards the negative. And I have a quote. So one thing, that book that, thank you, Monique, for posting the link to that mindfulness book. But in the book, they have a quote from an addict in recovery. It says, on the fifth anniversary of his last heroin and alcohol binge, Sam was asked to share his experience, strength, and hope in his 12-step meeting. And he shared the following. So I don't know why they have a quote from it, but it is an interesting quote. He says, and we've probably heard this in recovery circles before, but I find this to be a poignant quote. He says, "It is a strange thing to say, but I am grateful for my addiction. I feel more alive and connected to the people around me than I ever did. I appreciate all that is good in my life in a way I never did before. I wouldn't wish what I have been through because of addiction on anyone, but I'm grateful for the way the scales have fallen away from my eyes in recovery. Every day is an opportunity to practice appreciation and gratitude. I have friends who have died through addiction. Recently, a friend in recovery went on what he thought might be one last binge, and his body couldn't take it. It killed him, and he was only in his 30s. I start each day with prayer, and in my prayer, I'm grateful for each day of my recovery." So that's, for me, very poignant, because I had a friend who did something very similar in just last year, where we'd been in recovery together for over 20 years, and he relapsed and started drinking again, but very quietly and hiding it from everybody until he couldn't hide it anymore. And then at some point, he actually called me and said, Walt, I need help. And I helped him get into a treatment center. And then that seemed to be going well. But then after he got out of the treatment center, a few months later, he was drinking again. And then he went to another treatment center, etc. And then eventually he drank himself to death. He just never came back all the way. And and I, you know, one of the, I guess, one of the hidden gifts of that is that the people, those of us who were close to him, it was a really stark reminder of, you know, how you can get lost in your addiction and it can take you all the way out, you know. So that quote from Sam, whoever Sam is, really resonates for me. And I've had quite a few other friends over the years that have died as a result of their addictions and family members, etc. So it does help me to cultivate gratitude, as you know, just to remember these people that I've known and cared about who are no longer here, and realizing that could easily have been me, and just grateful that for whatever reason I'm still here. But anyway, so there's different ways we can cultivate gratitude, the contemplation on impermanence, that everything's impermanent, including us. And I don't know, my daughter is getting ready to go to bed, so I'm sorry if there's noise in the background. Let's see. So I got a little heavy there for a minute, but this is part of, you know, what keeping it real. And that is kind of one of the other topics I wanted to mention tonight, which is about something in Buddhism. It's called truthfulness, usually. Truthfulness, and that there is a Pali word for that too, Sacca, Sacca, but you don't need to remember that. But truthfulness, it's a what's called one of the paramis, the perfections, something that the Buddha, like somebody who wants to be fully enlightened, there's 10 qualities called the perfections that they work on or they cultivate that will hopefully lead them to awakening someday if they cultivate all these 10 very wholesome qualities. I don't know if people are familiar. The qualities are generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, loving kindness, metta, and equanimity, an evenness of mind. So those are the 10. And this one, the truthfulness, it also can be said to be real. Like, there's a quote from a monk that says, "Enlightenment is about getting real." And I love that because I feel like recovery is about getting real, right? We kind of just keep using until we start to realize how much we've been suffering. And at some point, we got to get real about it, right? And that's kind of makes the difference. Seeing things clearly. For me, it took, you know, a near-death experience, basically. I crashed a car and went through the windshield, and fortunately nobody else was involved. It was me and three cars, which isn't funny, but I'm just lucky to be alive. And I went through the windshield because I wasn't wearing a seatbelt, so my head smashed the windshield. But anyway, the good news is that did wake me up to the reality of my addictions, and how I realized if I kept going in that direction with my life, it wasn't going to last very long. And this is something that I think supports mindfulness as well, that we're mindful. That Jon Kabat-Zinn always says, with mindfulness, our welcome mat is out for everything, which I love. And it's so that we're not trying, it's not like we're just mindful of the, you know, pleasant stuff. We're mindful with, for what, with whatever's here, and we don't, and our only preference is to see things clearly, to know the truth of the way things are. And this is a powerful, powerful practice to really put our efforts towards. And I think it's made a huge difference in my life. It helps with parenting too. I think my wife is dealing with something right now. Sorry if there's a, I can't really do much about the sound. Is, can you hear stuff, or is it kind of being filtered by Zoom? That's good. All right, so there's also the thing about truthfulness is it's about non-deception. So we, I think there's, you know, we talk about denial in the addiction world, and that's a form of self-deception, right? We're deceiving ourselves, deceiving others. I mean, I was very deceptive when I was caught in my different addictions. You know, I didn't want everybody to know what I was up to. And that was a part of the addiction in a way. Yeah, we're really good at hiding things. My friend who passed away, I went, when he first went into treatment, he gave me his house keys and he said, can you go get my mail, check my mail, check on my place? Because, you know, he couldn't do that for however long he was in treatment, like a month or something. I think it was 2 months. And anyway, I was cleaning up his kitchen because it was really bad. I just wanted him, when he got out, I wanted him to come home to something reasonable. And I happened to open a cupboard and it was completely full of empty bottles of tequila. And it was all the same brand too. He always got the same brand. So it was kind of eerie. It was like, I counted the bottles. It was something like 19 empty bottles of tequila, which all of which he consumed completely by himself, home alone, you know. And it was very, that was pretty intense. But, you know, so he had been hiding this for quite a while. And he didn't take the bottles out and to put them in the recycling because he didn't want his neighbors to know what he was up to, right? So these are the kind of things that we do. So there's just this truthfulness is an important quality that we need to cultivate. And it's also about not telling deliberate lies. The Buddha cautioned his son, Rahula, who ordained as a monk under the Buddha. The Buddha said that for someone who's willing to tell a deliberate lie, there's no wrong that they won't do. Like once somebody's willing to tell a deliberate lie, then it kind of opens the door to all kinds of other sort of wrongdoing. Sometimes they quote like evil as the word, but I really don't want to like turning it into evil, but yeah, just that. And so, you know, we kind of dedicate ourselves to truthfulness, non-deception. You might, I guess the modern term might be transparency, that we try to be transparent. It's like, this is me, I'm doing this, and I have no secrets today. But also not deceiving ourselves. One of my teachers today is Bhikkhu Anālayo, or Venerable Anālayo. He's a German Buddhist monk who lives in Massachusetts and has written a lot of books. One is on Satipatthana meditation, a practice guide. And he said, self-deception is a means to avoid the displeasure of seeing our own shortcomings, and it stands diametrically opposed to the whole thrust of progress on the path of Satipatthana meditation, or the four foundations of mindfulness. So basically mindfulness meditation. So I think that's a powerful quote too. So this is what we mean in Buddhism when we talk about kind of being dedicated to truthfulness, that we're willing to look at our shortcomings. So again, this really matches what we hear, say, in the 12 steps in particular, in terms of recovery stuff, that we're willing to look at our shortcomings. We're not trying to avoid them. And it's not easy, so to look at our shortcomings, but I think it's really important. My wife and I did couples counseling at some point, and the counselor was kind of getting to know us, and she said, "So wait, Walt, you're I think I was in teacher training to be a Buddhist teacher then." She's like, "You're in teacher training and you're in recovery." And she's like, "Oh, this, and you're in this relationship, and now you're in counseling with me. So this means you're not going to get a, you don't get away with nothing. You're not going to get away with anything." Something like that. I was like, "Yeah, you're screwed." No, screwed. Oh, my defilements are screwed. My shortcomings are screwed. They're all going to be out there, right? I'm not going to. So, but it was, she was kind of joking, but kind of not. But this is what I've put myself into, right? And it was good. I learned a lot in that experience. But boy, yeah, it can be intense. So that's truthfulness. I mean, there's a, I'm kind of touching on these topics. There's a lot more. Well, the other thing, I do like this bit too, that I was reading this book called Dopamine Nation by Dr. Anna Lemke. She's a professor at Stanford, and she works with people with addictions. So I don't know if you're familiar with that book, but what I think is interesting is she, you know, had a lot of things she wanted to talk about in her book about dopamine and whatnot. But because she works with addicts, she saw the importance of radical, what she calls radical honesty. And I, somewhere she says, like, she didn't really want to have to include this in her book because it wasn't that much of a part of what her training was all about, but she couldn't deny how much, how important it had been in her patients' lives, as they got into recovery and got clean and got healthy, et cetera. So she felt she had to include a chapter on it, or it would be like a disservice. So she, and so I just have a couple quotes from her. She says, radical honesty, or telling the truth, is painful because we're actually wired to lie from an early age, which is interesting. And then she mentions that humans aren't the only animals with the capacity for deception. The animal kingdom is rife with examples of deception as a weapon and a shield. There's a certain beetle that's able to penetrate ant colonies by pretending to be one of them. Something it accomplishes by emitting a chemical substance that makes it smell like an ant. And once inside, the beetle feeds on ant eggs and larvae. So, and there's, I looked it up. There are a lot of animals that have different ways of deceiving each other or other species. One, lot, some of it's about mating. There's a, I think it's a cuttlefish. That the male cuttlefish, when it's swimming next to a female, if there's another male on the other side of it, it can show the signals to the female of a male and the signals to the male of a female. So the male looks at it and thinks it's two females swimming along. Meanwhile, the male, the other guy is, you know, trying to hook up with the with the real female. I don't know if you followed that, but it's like two sides of its body can put off different signals, apparently. I'd like to see a video of this, but anyway, I thought that was interesting. So yeah, that we, but she also says that no other animal rivals the human capacity for lying. And there's a whole, I'm not going to go deeply into that, but She says, radical honesty, though, telling the truth about things large and small, especially when doing so exposes our foibles and entails consequences, is essential not just to recovery from addiction, but for all of us trying to live a more balanced life in our reward-saturated ecosystem. Because she's talking about dopamine a lot. The reward center of the brain loves dopamine. So then she says, radical honesty promotes awareness of our actions. It fosters intimate human communications, and it leads to a truthful autobiography, which holds us accountable not just to our present, but also to our future selves. And she ends by saying, further, telling the truth is contagious and might even prevent the development of future addiction. Which is interesting. I mean, for me, I kind of do relate to that because the first time I went to a 12-step meeting was in a rehab treatment center. And so sort of like mandatory. But what hooked me immediately was how honest there were people from the outside community bringing the meeting into the treatment center. And those people were being, they would be so honest and self-revealing about their own foibles and shortcomings in front of the whole group. And I remember being shocked when I first heard this happening. I was like, because I hadn't heard people, most of the time, most people I knew were kind of defended and wanted to put on a good front at all times. And like there was this Vietnam veteran from a super famous family, apparently. Like I kind of knew who he was in a way. But he was saying things that you would never tell other, like you wouldn't make them up about yourself. They had to be true because they were so terrible. They put him in such a bad light, you know? He was talking about during his addiction. But I don't know, at the time it got my attention, and I realized the importance of starting to really be honest about my own shortcomings. And it may have saved my life, who knows? Because I got fairly serious about my recovery at a fairly young age. I was only 21 when I went into the first treatment center, and I fortunately have stayed in recovery since. So yeah, maybe his back, I just remember always that one guy's deep honesty really hit a chord with me at the time. So there's that, the truthfulness. And then the last topic that I was just going to touch on was around acceptance. Unfortunately, but I think these all kind of go together, and truthfulness and acceptance seem to be related. And now I'm going to stop talking in a few minutes and open it up and hear from some of you, but just share a few things about acceptance. And I have a quote from Kevin Griffin, his first book, One Breath at a Time, where he said, "The essence of practice is being aware of what's happening right now. But how often do we compare what's happening right now to some past experience or some ideal of what we think should be happening or wish would happen? This judging is not only painful and unproductive," he says, "but is in fact another trick of the mind to keep us from being present with what is. To be present with what is, we need to be accepting of the truth of our experience, not fight with it." Accepting of the truth of our experience. This doesn't preclude making an effort to deepen our practice, but there's a difference between seeing that our concentration is weak and judging ourselves for that weakness. We can use the tools of practice to deepen concentration without stirring up feelings of failure or frustration. I love that because that I used to be the one, I used to be very good at kind of beating myself up. And it took me a while to realize that's all just extra, right? It's totally unnecessary. It's interesting because I recently discovered the great new sport of pickleball that some of you may. It's apparently the fastest growing sport in the US or something. And I used to play a lot of tennis, and I was even when I was part of the Stoner tennis team in my high school. We I won't go into too many details, but it's like the whole team liked to get stoned and play tennis. So I was playing pickleball, and I hadn't been playing a lot of racket sports for a while, but I grew up playing them a lot. And what I got into some old habits, because if I missed a shot, I would instantly say my bad kind of thing, because that's like how I used to play all the time. And so kind of like what we're talking about, where I would take it on, like I screwed up kind of thing, beat myself up a little. But I love, like, a lot of people in pickleball, part of the there's like an ethos in pickleball to be kind, at least generally speaking. Obviously, you could encounter all kinds of people out there, but generally, and so the people I was playing with were like, no, don't say my bad. It's pickleball. Just keep playing. Like, they're just like, I don't know, it's kind of like the enlightened pickleball players or something, but it was a great reminder. I just saw like an old habit that was popping up. Anyway, so I appreciate what Kevin's saying. And if we beat ourselves up enough, we might go out and go back to whatever our drug or behavior of choice might be. So I think it's really important to be aware of these sort of negative habits that we can get into and try to bring mindfulness to them and let them go. You might call that the second arrow, right? The first arrow in Buddhism is something we can't avoid. Bad things will happen to us. People get cancer, people close to us eventually die, these kind of like all kinds of we lose jobs, whatever. That's the first arrow that we couldn't avoid. But the second arrow we could avoid, but we shoot ourselves with it. And it's our reactivity to the first arrow. It's how we respond. Like if I'm beating myself up because I missed a pickleball shot, then that's a second arrow that could easily be avoided, right? But, and that's just a goofy example, but we do this in, more harmful ways a lot of the time. A lot of times you hear that word should, like this shouldn't be happening, right? Something happens, that first arrow, and what we say to ourselves is, oh, this shouldn't be happening. I shouldn't be having to go through this, right? But we have to remember that everything's coming out of certain causes and conditions, which is another Buddhist teaching. And so if it shouldn't be happening, it wouldn't be, right? It is happening. The truth here is that this is what's happening now. And so this is where acceptance comes in too, where we do have to accept, life on life's terms, as we say. And it's a powerful part of practice. All right, so I feel like I'm talking a lot. I'm gonna just end with one more thing about acceptance. And I think it's a story about His Holiness the Dalai Lama. I just think this is a funny story. It's in the book One Dharma by Joseph Goldstein. He says, when His Holiness the Dalai Lama spoke at several sessions of the Buddhist Christian conference at Gethsemane Abbey, which is in Kentucky, I believe, simply by being in the room with him, Joseph writes, I felt aspects of his kindness, his childlike ease and humor and imprint on my mind. He felt like those qualities imprinting on his mind. The Dalai Lama had been taken on a tour of the abbey and shown the various enterprises begun by the monks to support the monastery, including making cheese and fruitcakes. When the Dalai Lama spoke to the assembly of monks and guests later that evening, he recounted the tour, saying that the monks kept offering him samples of cheese when all he wanted was a piece of fruitcake. And as he was telling this story, his whole body shook with laughter. He, quote, "I really wanted fruitcake, and they kept offering me cheese," he said again and again, laughing the whole time. Joseph writes, "There was no distress, no real disappointment, just an openness to the experience he had had. He wasn't judging the monks or himself." The arising of faith can come in many ways, Joseph says, sometimes just by being with a person who opens us to a new possibility, a new way of being. But I love that the Dalai Lama's like, "I just want some fruitcake," but they kept offering him cheese. But just the fact that he just was like laughing about it, he didn't turn it into a problem. A coworker of mine when I worked at Spirit Rock, he had this notebook he carried around it to meetings all the time. And on the front, it just said, "Don't problem, don't problem." And I love that. I think that was like a Dharma teaching every time I saw him in his notebook, because we're so good at probleming, right? Like adding that second dart. But if we can just accept things as they are, and then it doesn't mean like the serenity prayer, we make changes where needed, but you have to start by acknowledging what's happening now, right? The truthful aspect. And then to remember to be grateful, as the Buddha instructed us, for whatever favors are done to us, whatever positive things are happening, not to lose sight of that as well. So thank you for listening. It's a lot of quotes and things. Now I'd like to open it up, hear from some of you all. Any questions, comments, sharings? Just good to hear from others and see what's on your minds. And if you have something else you want to talk about, we could, if it's related to Buddhism and recovery, I'm happy to go there as well. Let's see. So may any merit that arises from our practice here together tonight be for the benefit of those suffering from addictions of any kind, and may all beings, including ourselves, be happy, peaceful, and free. Okay, thank you.